You're listening to the Outclassed podcast with Mike Redding and Blake Seifert, exploring excellence in teaching, tech, and leadership.
So welcome back to the Outclassed podcast. And we're out of the dungeon this week, Mike. We're back in the land of the living, out of my garage, recording here in my company's offices today. And I notice you're somewhere different, Mike, with the horse in the background today.
Yeah, I'm down at Christchurch, just doing a bit of work down here and then spending a long weekend with the family and just staying on. So yeah, it's good to be out and about and traveling a bit.
Oh, it sure is. And we're very lucky today to be joined by the esteemed researcher, Neil Selwyn from Monash University, who has a long history, 25 years in education research. And Neil's been a valuable critic in the space. And one of the things I admire about him is his humility to come on a podcast like this and, you know, engage with people in schools and around, you know, so many different topics. And he's one of those people that makes me rethink my perspectives on very tough topics. So I'm very lucky to have him with us today. And there's so much material we could dive into. It'd be impossible to cover everything I think Neil's written about. He's written about so much. But my hope today is that we can challenge some of those fundamentals, some of the views around ed tech, and hopefully give us more tools for thinking about things like, you know, how we should view ed tech research, what the role of these big tech companies is in our schools, a little around learning analytics, which I know is something that Neil's spoken a lot about. And of course, AI in schools and the premise of his book, Should Robots Replace Teachers, which is a really fascinating provocation. So of course, anywhere else that we end up with this conversation is always an exciting journey on this podcast. So big welcome to Neil. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
So I'd like to start, if I can, Mike, just with a little primer here around the role of education research. And perhaps Neil could just kind of help our listeners and me for that matter, understand how we should think about and view education research inside of a school. So, you know, we get a lot of things. I know that a lot of schools sort of worship at the altar of John Hattie's research. We have all these tools that are kind of pushed on us saying, hey, this is best research. You know, Microsoft have their 21st century learning design, which I think was out of the UK. You know, we're getting a lot of messages, a lot of stuff. And people like to say as well, I've noticed lately, there's a lot of people saying, oh, I read this study. And what they mean is they read a news article that cited a study. So I'm keen to kind of dig into that a little and figure out, you know, what advice do you have for us as practitioners in the school that can kind of help us figure out what, you know, what all this means and help us navigate it without sort of resting back on our laurels and saying it's all too hard and reverting to our own observations and gut feelings solely.
Yeah, I mean, that's a really good question. So I've worked for 25 years as an education researcher. I've never worked in schools. I've got no experience of teaching whatsoever. So in that respect, I'm not really that qualified to tell a teacher what to do, what works and why, you know, all the usual questions that we get. What I can do is take a kind of more detached view and kind of look at the wider picture. So the kind of research I doesn't necessarily try to improve best practice or point towards what should or shouldn't be done in the classroom, but looks at the kind of how it all joins up. So looking at many different schools, many different systems, many different types of technology. So in that respect, I think my research sort of sits in the background. And I guess the aim I have for everything that I do is to change the nature of the conversation around technology and education. So I wouldn't tell a teacher what to do, but as you said, I think in your introduction, I try and give some ideas or some different perspectives or some provocations to get people thinking, particularly about the bigger picture. What's interesting with EdTech, though, as you say, everyone is kind of spruiking evidence left, right, and center. And in some ways, if someone's telling you they know the answer about technology, they've probably got something to sell. So there's no one right way of doing things with technology. There's no kind of clear answer. If so, we'd be doing it because we've been researching this and using technology in education for 30, 40 years. So we would have figured it out by now if there was a simple answer. And in some ways, when you said there's lots of evidence being produced, it's kind of like evidence in the legalistic sense. If you're a solicitor or a lawyer, you'd be gathering evidence to back up your own particular point of view to build up an argument. So Microsoft, you know, all the people coming out with their own independent evaluations are trying to push a particular line. And I'd also argue that academic researchers in EdTech are often trying to push a line as well. Many people that work in this area are trying to prove that technology is a good thing, that there is a potential for, you know, socio-constructivist learning or mobile learning, whatever the flavor of the month is. So no research is neutral, no research is objective, no research is going to give you a one-size-fits-all answer. And I quite like, I think it's Yong Zhao, who's a really interesting American researcher. He's a good voice to listen to, actually. He said in the blog post last month, the question of does it work in terms of tech and education is the most meaningless question to ask about online education. It's a really interesting blog post. And he basically says, decades of research about online learning has been unable to give a definitive answer to the question, does it work? And the best answer we can give is, it depends. And that's where my research comes in. It depends on what? It depends on how the program's delivered, how you're measuring the outcomes, whose interests are being considered, and then the context and the design and delivery and the technology and the student and the teacher and loads of different other factors. So no one can give you a straight answer through all of that. So I would always advise teachers to, trust your own gut instinct, and also talk to other people in similar contexts and circumstances as yourselves. The people who are going to know how tech works best in your classroom are people who are working in similar types of classrooms with similar types of students, similar types of curriculums. And that's kind of where you can probably get the best help immediately. And then academic research and, kind of company research and the rest of it can kind of push you in different directions, but it's never going to give you the answer.
Can sort of help you affirm suspicions sometimes or focus your thinking a little bit. But one of the challenges that I've sort of had to grapple with is my initial thought on education research would be that it's a progressive machine that's moving us closer towards this utopian end goal. But as you get older and and wiser to this, you sort of realize, okay, well, actually, in many ways, you're opening one door, opening one inquiry reveals 20, 30, 50 new doors, of which reveal another 50 new doors. And so sometimes we're actually maybe getting bogged down into the quicksand more, especially from a practitioner's point of view, that can paralyze you rather than empower you.
Yeah, paralysis by analysis, I think, is one of the things that Hattie talks about. I mean, in a way, you're right. Ed tech research is interesting because a lot of people in ed tech, I think it's a very positive project. So a lot of academics working in ed tech really believe that technology can make a difference to learning and teaching. The whole field of technology enhanced learning or computer assisted learning says what it does on the tin. You know, it's a kind of given statement that technology makes learning better. And so in that respect, it is a progressive ed tech research and can tend to be a kind of progressive practice. The flip side of that is it's often focused on what could happen, what should happen, what potentially might happen with the technology. And there's less interest in what's actually happening at the moment, which is of no use to teachers because teachers want to know what's happening at the moment. What apps should I buy? Instead of, in theory, mobile phones could be supporting all forms of creative learning. So my research, my approach is very contradictory to all of that. And I'm much more interested in what I call the state of the actual rather than the state of the art. But I think most ed tech research is really interested in the state of the art. And the other kind of get out clause for lots of academic research is to say, oh, it's all very complicated and it's all very complex, which is what you were hinting at before. Good academic research will tell you why it's complicated and help you join up the dots. So teaching is incredibly tricky to make sense of. Academic research, when it's done well, should help you make sense of that complexity and navigate your way through. So you can't ignore the complexity, but neither can you just throw your hands in the air and say, well, it's all too difficult, because capitalism or because neoliberalism or because the curriculum or whatever it is, those aren't helpful conclusions.
Yeah, I'm interested in that because, like, for me personally, being a teacher, like, I have never pursued a master's in education or further study in that sense because I've just often reflected on those who have gone through a master's or, those that have done a lot of research on a particular model of teaching, and then I see it in the school and it seems to have made very little difference whatsoever in terms of their leadership capacity or in terms of boots on the ground or change at the coalface, however you want to explain it. So in terms of, like, obviously you're an academic and you teach as part of a master's degree. One of our trainers, Samantha, she did the master's at Monash and loved it. And so I'm trying to balance up the value around, where does educational research add value in terms of what we're doing? Is it just prodding us to think clearer or I'm a little bit perplexed on that front.
Yeah, I mean, like, talking of my own research, I would never tell a teacher what to do. There are plenty of colleagues and plenty of other education researchers who are very focused on kind of producing kind of very clear guidelines and best practice. And you know, education researchers have had their fingers in all sorts of things, you know, national curriculum reforms, assessment. You mentioned John Hattie earlier. I mean, clearly he's making an impact for better or worse on how education takes place. So there is lots of education research, which is very kind of school focused and teacher focused. And increasingly we're under pressure to produce research which is applied rather than purely theoretical and purely academic. I take much more of the kind of purely academic, purely theoretical point of view, because I'm not a teacher and I haven't got any real interest in telling teachers what to do. Actually, my research focuses a lot more on students, because I have been a student and I've got a lot of kind of practical experience in that. And I was fascinated when I first came to university, and I just took a couple of education technology courses. This was in the early 90s, actually, so I want to say. And I was getting told all sorts of rubbish about computers are going to help kids do this and help kids do that. And I was like, well, in my experience, that wasn't happening at all. We weren't even allowed to go on. And that's what actually set me off, was hearing this educational research about students and thinking it didn't ring true. So I can kind of sympathize with teachers now, thinking that the research they're reading doesn't ring true. There is good practical teacher-applied research out there. And as I say, we're increasingly under pressure to produce that. And so we should in a faculty of education, particularly those of us that work educating teachers. So it's there if you can look for it. And I think the criticism always used to be that education academics weren't interested in even writing in a way that teachers can engage with. And I think that's changing. And although Blake was kind of laughing about reading stuff on blogs, things like blogs and podcasts and other Twitter are really useful ways for academics to engage. I mean, academics are clearly not perfect, but I think if the stuff that you seem to be looking for, Mike, it is out there. Don't look at academic journals, don't read books, but maybe look at seeing what the researchers are actually producing online. That might be a way forward. But academics don't have the answers. Teachers don't have the answers. Policymakers don't have the answers. But together, I think we can kind of begin to make sense of what's going on. But there's never going to be a solution. You know, we've been doing education schools for 100 years plus, and we're still not entirely sure what we're doing. That in some ways is the beauty of it. If it was really straightforward, we would I don't think half of us would be working here. We like a challenge.
That's true. And you're right in the sense that revolution that we were promised never really materialized. And certainly from an IT director's standpoint, you know, we spend a lot of time implementing technology and trying to evangelize and to raise confidence in that technology. And of course, you know, we want to make sure we're not being doing it with no kind of outcome, that it has an impact and it's not all for naught. But that's sort of one of the big questions that I have, is around this digital education revolution that we're promised. What I sort of see when I'm implementing tools is where we can make gains, where we can make impact, seems to be around those core tenets of human behavior. So around things like productivity, around making people communicate, or better access to communication, more collaboration and those kind of formats. So what I haven't seen is the revolution of, wow, you know, we're completely upending the way we deliver content now, or the way in which the content is created, written. I think the underlying building blocks have changed, the underlying lowest common denominator, if you like, of how we communicate and those kind of core basic things of any organization have I think improved in what we can do now remotely and with all the lockdown that's been happening and everything. I think we've seen very good examples of that. But in terms of what's happening with the curriculum, what's happening with outcomes for students, we've put in effort over effort, and you know, many schools full-time trying to improve. But you could argue that even test scores and outcomes of ATARs and things like that haven't really moved much with all this innovation and with all this improvement. Yeah, so I'm interested to sort of hear what your take on that is.
I was going to say, I haven't got an answer, fortunately, to that. I mean, that's why I like that Yong Zhao quote, because he's talking about everything else it depends on, which is, as you've said, from kind of who the individual student is all the way through to the system and beyond. And so in some ways, technology is very good at the basic ways of working. As you said, we can now send things via Dropbox or Zoom each other, and you know, communication and basic ways of working have been enhanced by technology. And also there are plenty of wow things that you're aware of and I'm aware of in the lab, or in kind of proof of concept in a beta state. I mean, there are plenty of really exciting ways of learning, teaching and being creative. What happens is, so the disconnect that you're pointing towards is when you then put that in the classroom. And not just in one classroom, because there's plenty of evidence and evaluation of doing a wow technology in one classroom with a super enthused teacher, really good kids, great tech support. But when you try and scale it up across a school or across a system, that's where things begin to fall down. And in some ways, that's where kind of research like mine perhaps comes in to help a little bit by, well, first of all, saying it's not your fault. It's not the technology's fault. In some ways, it's the system. And I really like the historian Larry Cuban. He writes, he looked at technologies throughout the 20th century that were meant to revolutionize teaching and learning in schools, starting off with the film strip and the radio, the television, the micro. And there was a whole range. I mean, God, if game-changing technologies, radio and television in the 20th century completely transformed, you know, the way that the world was. What impact did they have on the classroom? Very little. And that's why Cuban was really interested in why that was the case and how that might apply to digital technologies. And he wrote about the grammar of schooling. I mean, his famous paper was called Computer Meets Classroom, Classroom Wins. And what he was talking about there was how classrooms and schools and education systems shape anything that comes into them along their own lines. So if you think you mentioned curriculum, assessment, timetabling, all of these things tend to shape the ways that really interesting wow technologies get actually used in practice. And a lot of the digital technologies do get shaped around things like, you know, having to have a class that runs for an hour in a school that runs from 9 to 3, and all of these things which are kind of perhaps antithetical to the wow factor of technology, which is its hyperconnectivity, you know, the idea about doing things in an asynchronous way. All these flexibilities don't fit with a system that isn't necessarily thinking along the same lines. So in that respect, that's why the wow stuff doesn't take place across a whole school system. The big question there is, and this is where a lot of the tech evangelists start arcing up, is, oh, we should change the system. Schools are outmoded, you know, 19th century institutions based around agricultural factory work, blah, 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 blah. And that's where it gets really dangerous, because then we move into not the territory of talking about how can we get wow technologies to work in the classroom, but should we fundamentally restructure the whole nature of schooling? Which is a massive question, which shouldn't be just dealt with by tech companies or tech researchers like myself. So there is a big disconnect. I think there are a few areas where I'm sure people listening could point to some really cool things which are taking place with technology. I mean, I'm really interested in the way that technologies kind of enhance the experience of students with learning difficulties, for example. And lots of the technology in the area of autism, it seems really. So there are pockets of where technology has made an impact in the system. But on a big basic level, if you've got a system of examinations and coursework and curriculums which are fixed, you can see why the technology falls down. And teachers and students just revert to kind of getting through the school year, getting the grade and getting out of there. And actually, if you want to see the really interesting wow stuff, it takes place when students and teachers are not in the classroom, when perhaps they're at home making videos or playing Minecraft or doing all the stuff, the informal learning. And that's really valuable learning, but not necessarily school learning.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I'm reflecting this morning with my daughter. She's in year 11, equivalent for high school in Australia. And last year, at the end of the year exams, she was showing me after everyone had finished, I think it was the English exam or the maths exam, and there were some really hard questions in there. Not like my generation, we would have gone and chatted about it on the bus on the way home, or, you know, maybe a little bit younger than us, I might have shared it on Facebook or something like that. But she just showed me TikTok after TikTok after TikTok of all these students who are reacting to the exam questions and wondering what it was about, and some people even offering solutions. But it wasn't, the thing that fascinated me was the creativity these students had, the communication skills they had. I was like, man, this beats any essay I've seen in a school, hands down. And why more teachers aren't embracing this, I've got no clue.
Well, you're right. And it's really interesting to think about things like that. Or whenever anyone gives me an example of technology like that, the really interesting question to ask is, what is new here? So what your daughter was doing was exactly the same as what you'd have been doing on the bus, but she was doing it through a different medium. But as you say, the what is new here is bits of the creativity, the fact it was done in an asynchronous way. Maybe it was reaching a wider audience, and maybe they were having richer discussions because of it, or maybe not. So it's not like it's a completely different way of being, but there is something different going on here. And there's lots and lots of examples like that. But the question then is, if we're not going to just get rid of schools completely, how can schools capture this, you know, the exciting stuff that takes place around the edges of technology use? How can we bring informal practices into formal school And there have been attempts to do this. The trouble I see is when anyone tries to bring anything cool into school, it immediately doesn't become cool. I mean, there's that cliche about bringing computer games into maths. It becomes chocolate covered broccoli. Just because it's covered in chocolate, kids don't like to eat it. I would be very wary about saying, let's have TikTok-based assignments, and which is where some people would like to go. But on the other hand, neither can you deny that TikTok exists. And this is why I'm really interested in the mobile phone bans that have been rolled out across a lot of Australian states, for example. We know mobile phones can be used for really cool things, really creative things, really interesting ways of communication. Why ban them from schools? Yeah. Well, of course, there are a whole bunch of kind of practical reasons why some teachers are willing to ban. But we've got this weird relationship in education with technology. We want it to be used well and creatively and have that wow factor. But on the other hand, there's a whole bunch of structures and other kind of concerns, which are very important and shouldn't be discounted, but perhaps get in the way. But, it's the same in if I was working for a huge Big Four accountancy company in the middle of New York. I'm sure they wouldn't be very happy if I was goofing around on TikTok. And so it's not just schools. We shouldn't just blame schools and blame teachers and say they're old-fashioned. But there are interesting tensions there that I think we need to think about, and not just assume that schools are broken, or not just assume that technology has no place in schools.
And then we also have to be mindful of the pressures on teachers that, they're looking for an outcome. They're looking for a test score. They're looking for an ATAR a number value at the end of the day that they can decide if that was successful or not with. And that's unfortunately a way a lot of decisions are made in schools, particularly around, this data play. And I know, having followed your work for a while, you often talk about how data has become the most important topic in education in the last sort of maybe 15 years, I suppose, 20 years, and its use, and how that sort of funnels back, and the teachers end up being, slaves to the data rather than the teachers using the data to improve what they're doing. And you sort of see that in this discourse between what's important with the teaching, what are the tools we need? And we talk about, mobile phone bans is kind of an effect of this, where phones were disruptive in class, but then banning them from schools that say don't have a proficient one-to-one platform that's equitable, where every student has the same access, now you're creating sort of an uneven problem in the classroom. We have schools, especially in regional Victoria, where uptakes of their BYOD programs are 50-60% of students. So if you take phones out of the equation, the other 40% of students are presumably spinning their circles and writing on a piece of paper while other people are investigating things online and have access to all the world's information at their fingertips. So I think that does create an equity problem that we need to think about. And, I think people like this idea of a blanket ban. And I know in your work as well, there's a lot of support now we're seeing for, what's happening with the data. Parents are more informed about and more worried about the use of social media with kids and all these things. So the immediate sort of knee-jerk reaction is to ban things. And I think that's always going to get a good political response, because we see it in our houses, we see it everywhere, this sort of need to, kind of stop our children from being exposed to social media and their inability to kind of moderate themselves, especially younger students where their brains aren't fully developed yet, to have those higher order, sort of more mature approaches to the technology.
Yeah, and absolutely. Everything you've just said there is not what we normally speak about when we speak about ed tech. These are the state of the actual issues that we tend to kind of gloss over when we're talking about, but in a few years' time, when we're all on TikTok, we'll be doing X, Y, and Z. And so at the beginning of what you were saying there, you were just pointing to the fact that teachers are just trying to do a good job. If you fund, and actually so are students. So even when we've talked to students about, how could you possibly take some of your cool stuff that you're doing outside of school into school? A lot of them will say, we're not bothered about this. We just want to get through, do school properly, get the work done, and then get out of there. And we'll play Fortnite when we're at home. And they're quite aware that doing school involves a certain way of doing technology. And the same with teachers. As you say, if teachers are having to get good ATAR scores and that's what they're getting judged by, then of course they're not going to be messing around with TikTok and computer games and everything else. That's not to say that we should change the assessment system just to encourage these uses of technology. And also the equity issues you were talking about as well, that's state of the actual. And these COVID school shutdowns that we've been recording this in May, so we're just coming out of it. But we've seen lots and lots of students not being able to do very basic online learning because of lack of internet connectivity, lack of devices, lack of technical support, the social envelope that you need around any online learning if it takes place outside of the school. And conversely, we've actually seen how useful schools are in providing that support. Lots of students, I think, are able to do work at school with technology that they can't do outside. These are all conversations that it's really useful to get out in the open and start thinking about and being aware of. And then we can be just more realistic in the ways that we try and imagine how technologies can be used. And maybe we actually might find a few more interesting uses of technology by kind of scaling back our expectations. But all of this stuff is really, really interesting to me. And it annoys me that it's not talked about so much. And that's what I mean when changing the nature of the conversation. It's not that technology is good or bad. It's just that we need to just talk a bit more, in a bit more nuanced way about it.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I've had a lot of conversations with school principals in the last week and a half with schools starting to come back. And every conversation has turned to how do we embrace blended learning now? Like they've seen some of the positives of working from home and students learning and having a bit of, I guess, autonomy over when they learn, how they learn, where they learn, in a sense, what they learn as well. And they're saying, well, how do we take the best of this and, you know, incorporate that into a traditional school structure and a way of teaching? Have you seen any good models around that or got any advice for school leaders who would be trying to blend those two worlds as we start to merge back in again?
Yeah, I mean, the first thing I would say is that what we've just been through over the past few months is not EdTech at its best. This hasn't been a very good example of online learning or blended learning at all. This has been emergency remote learning done at very quick pace. We weren't really ready for this. Mm-hmm. And so what's taken place, I think, is everyone's got by. No one's really thrived. We've all survived. One of the things I'm really interested in, though, is for schools to actually now take stock of what happened. There have been plenty, I mean, teachers and students and parents have kind of rallied around and have really kind of stepped up. But what did seem to work? But on the other hand, what didn't work and how can we support those families and those teachers and those curriculum areas in the future? I'm looking at the research coming out of the States and the UK at the moment. Not much has been done in New Zealand or Australia. It seems to be that people have been doing less work. They've been opting out of particular curriculum areas. Mostly teachers think that the quality of work has slightly decreased in quality. People have been it's been kind of quite basic stuff. I'd hate for us to try and replicate that again. But as you say, there is an enthusiasm for some of the stuff to perhaps pivot over to this more blended model. One of the things I think that's coming out of the initial research is that the need to support families and households that can't keep up, as Blake was saying earlier, additional support, kind of additional sessions live face-to-face, or at least face-to-face through Zoom, sessions with teachers to support students and families that are struggling. So I think we need to build that kind of protective bubble around some students. But as you say, others will thrive and, you know, why not blended? I would be wary about doing that at primary level. I think there's a real need for primary schools for all sorts of non-learning reasons, you know, just for social reasons. But I think we already are seeing blended approaches at upper secondary levels. I mean, particularly say in classes where people are learning Asian languages, for example, and there isn't an Asian language teacher, it makes sense to drop out and have an online course. Mm-hmm. And similarly, we have virtual schools in Victoria. We've had virtual schools for many years in Victoria. And done properly, a lot of preparation and planning, they can work. But everything that's happened in the past few months shouldn't be used as a kind of, you shouldn't feel guilt-tripped or see it as a reason to kind of suddenly revert to teaching all your lessons now on Zoom. I think we should try and go back to how we were, but then also take a bit of time to reflect on what's happened and just see, was there anything, you know, that might have a kind of glimmer of hope for the future? But this has to be worked out on a school-by-school basis. What works in a really wealthy school in the southeast of Melbourne is not necessarily going to work in regional Victoria. There's no one-size-fits-all. So for a whole school system to pivot over to blended learning in this particular way would be a worry. But I'm sure individual schools can work it out. One of the interesting things from the research in the UK and the States is that private schools seem to have been doing a lot better, unsurprisingly, because they've got the technology, they've got the resources, they've had the systems set up. So in a way, that can give us hope for those of us that work in government schools and public schools, that if you do have a kind of a solid technical background, you've got, you know, households and parents that have good trust between, et cetera, that could be seen as a kind of proof of concept, you know. But really the answer relies in making sure that all your parents and your households and your teachers are well-resourced and well-equipped and, you know, all come from nice middle-class backgrounds, which is never going to happen. So it's really tricky. But this whole thing, oh, we must now switch to blended because we've been on Zoom for 2 months. I think we need to roll back from that.
Yeah, and it's interesting the dichotomy you talk about there of how there are stories of things working really well. I had a teacher come to me saying how he's loving the submissions he's getting from his students, far more thoughtful, far more, you know, less pressure on their submission in terms of they can sit at home in their own environment and write it. But then we're also having students that haven't shown up at all, that have been MIA. So you sort of got these two extremes happening at the same time. And your comment on private schools, I'm not surprised by that. And I'd probably add a little more color to that conversation as well. And in that, one of the factors I think that plays a big role in it is in the types of students you're getting going to private schools are generally the types of students that value education, or their families value education. There's a cultural value for education in there. And it's the same where I am. You know, I'm not at a private school, but our school attracts people to the zone, to live in that zone, who want their kids to go to a good school. So there is a culture of valuing education at our school, and we see that. And so absolutely, we wouldn't see the same thing, you know, school down the road that's struggling and, you know, losing enrollments or isn't perceived as a quote unquote, you know, good school. So, you know, I think there is nuance in that. And I agree that, you know, sort of saying, okay, well, now we've got this new paradigm, let's launch with it. I think we need to be careful about even what we take back in now and the sorts of things. Yeah, this might have worked well and we have some success stories, but it is anecdotal. And that's where we want to look to research and these other paradigms to help us make educated decisions about a real means-tested proof that this stuff can work. And I'm keen, Mike, to hear your perspective on this. Having children that are remote schooled, I suppose you'd call it, in New Zealand, moving from, you know, state schools in Sydney where they used to go into this remote school environment. We've discussed this a few times, but what do you see as those challenges coming back in? And, you know, just does it only work because obviously you're a family that values education and you're interested in their educational journeys? Do you think if the families were, you know, lower socioeconomic areas where they're just trying to make ends meet, don't have time to, you know, engage with their kids on that level, do you think it has the same impact?
Yeah, there's no real easy answer to that, because I mean, our kids were in the state school system in New South Wales and in a grammar school, and then over to New Zealand, which had a very much more of a fluid kind of pedagogy and curriculum. And I know my kids initially really struggled with the freedom where a teacher would come up to them and say, where do you think you are in your learning journey and what would you like to work on next? And my kids would just look at them and just, they may well have asked it in Chinese because I had no idea what to even do with a question like that when they've come from a grammar school that says you'll do this many words, you'll write it this way, you'll rule your margins, like everything was controlled. And then to take it a step back from that, where now our kids are in an online school because we travel, for them to go and fit back into a school system, I think there'd be pros and cons to that. Like, they definitely would gain value out of being in a cohort of being with students and discussing things and thrashing ideas out. They do a lot of Zoom calls. I don't know. I wrestle with it, to be honest, because like Neil said earlier, there's no right or wrong way to do things. We just see positives and advantages wherever we go. For us, I feel for where our kids are at, and then we don't look over their shoulder too much. We pretty much let them be in terms of their schooling, let the teachers hold them accountable and so on. But we just see so much better output from them. And I wonder how much of that's got to do with technology use and technology enablement versus good teacher practice. But yeah, I think because there's so many bits and pieces in that contribute to an outcome, I'm not exactly sure where I sit on all of that just yet.
Mm. If we switch gears for a moment, you know, one of the answers to this that a lot of people are touting is this learning analytics idea that we could find out, Mike. All we need to do is, you know, put some good measures in place and we could compare apples to apples. So I need to hear, obviously, your overarching thoughts on this, Neil, and I know that they're probably going to be in the same vein of we're not sure, and maybe it adds value, maybe it doesn't. But we know there's a lot of schools in the States that were pilot schools for these kind of data-driven schools that were going to have everything was around data. I think one of them was Alt Schools. I know, Mike, we were talking about this just pre-show, how they ended up getting, I think, closed down. I don't know too much about that, but what's sort of your take in this area, Neil?
I might stay quiet on Alt Schools. They pivoted, so they no longer exist. which is a bummer for the teachers and the parents and the students that were actually attending them. But I guess the shareholders thought differently. And actually, Alt Schools was set up by Google's ex-head of personalization. So they were testing out a whole bunch of ideas about data-driven schooling. There's an interesting kind of slippage here. I mean, you're right, there's been a huge push for data-driven schools over the past 20 years. And that's about teachers using performance data to, you know, change their practice. Learning analytics is slightly different. So it's coming more from a kind of tech perspective. And it's the idea, at least how it's been playing out in higher education, that there's a whole bunch of data generated by the digital technologies that we use that can maybe give us some clues on where learning's going. So I think the data-driven schooling thing is still very much based around how can we use ATARs and PISA scores and, you know, SACs and GACs and everything else. Learning analytics is about how can we use the trace data that's generated by the use of the learning management system. How can we use, you know, mobile phone data? There's all sorts of stuff from the tech. And in a way, that's quite interesting. There's a whole range of data being generated by tech use. And if we're learning through technology, why not use it to give us an insight on what's going on? So I can see the principle. What's interesting is that in higher education, at least, it is learning analytics. And it's analytics for the learner and the student to make decisions about their learning. The teacher's cut out of the loop completely. So a lot of this comes from the idea of behavioral economics and the idea of nudging people to make good decisions and this whole idea of self-regulated learning. So the idea is that a system will give a student feedback on the stuff they've done. It will try and infer their mood and their attitude and their learning style and a whole bunch of other things and say, well, on the basis of everything you're doing, why don't you do this? Why don't you do that? So we're seeing these personalized learning systems and recommender systems that are kind of giving students a kind of pathway through learning. The teacher, on the other hand, has to stand back from all of this. And the idea is it frees the teacher up to maybe diagnose at a wider level and to work with students that are particularly struggling. But the basic premise of learning analytics is helping the learner learn better. What's interesting is that when they're now trying to apply it to K-12 schooling, they're finding out very quickly that schools don't work in that way. And they're kind of pivoting to what they're now calling teacher analytics, which is, I guess, again, this idea of schools and classrooms shaping technologies. The idea of learning analytics is great in a university, perhaps, where students are adults and can make their own decisions. It doesn't work so well in schools. So it's been a buzz area for the past 10 years. And there's a big interest in getting it into schools. I'm, as you can imagine, quite skeptical about it. But, you know, technology is generating continuous data flows every minute on a student. An ATAR is once every career. So I think one of the systems, Newton, for example, it has 1 million data points on each learner and it knows a student far more than any teacher ever could. And that's quite powerful if you're a policymaker or a school leader. Your ears prick up at that point and go, ah, right, okay. So you can see why people are buying into it. I think there are a few issues where we might want to push back.
Yeah, there's that old trope that where schools are data rich but information poor, where we have lots of data points and they're all sort of flooding us by and we're not actually picking up the pieces out of that and looking at, well, this is important. You know, we're missing kids here. We've got cruisers in this cohort or whatever it may be. But interesting, we talk about learning analytics and the little vision you've made there between teaching analytics and learning analytics. When we talk about learning analytics in K-12, my understanding of it is exactly what you're describing as teacher analytics. And in fact, learning analytics would be a little controversial, having just the students' access to this data that the teachers are kind of not privy to or not really tracking, which is, I think, still an interesting idea. But that, I think, goes to show that the differences in the K-12 system versus the university system, where it is very teacher focused and it is what we call scaffolded in the classroom. And there's a lot of, you know, like a lot of emphasis is put on classroom management. Whenever new tools come in, whether it's, you know, using Google Docs collaboratively, the first thing we get questions about is, well, how do we know who did what in the document and how do we stop kids from deleting things and those kind of behavioral issues rather than sort of the focus on the learning issues. So I find that sort of division really interesting, teacher analytics, and the fact that I haven't heard that before, even more interesting. But also that should be an indication of where we're at with analytics, I think, in high schools. You know, McKinnon is a very forward-focused school. We've always been at, like you say, data-driven school with PISA and these kind of things. But I haven't seen really any schools in all the consulting I've done and working with schools around the country that are doing teacher analytics end to end and siphoning all the data through their systems. I'm not sure how far down that road we are and whether we'll even get there? I mean, you were saying this has been around for, was it 15 years, Neil?
Yeah, absolutely. And an example of schools that were doing it were alt schools that you mentioned previously, and they pivoted. So, yeah. Well, I mean, the interesting thing about all this, I mean, whether it's teacher analytics or learning analytics, there are some issues here. All right, we have a million data points, but a million data points of what? If we're looking at just the use of learning management systems, it's swipes and clicks and hours spent on videos, et cetera, et cetera. But you have to ask yourself, what is this representative of and what is not representative of? What can we actually infer through the amount of time a student spends on a particular area of the learning management system? So we've talked to some of our university students about learning analytics. I remember I was interviewing one girl and she said, oh, yeah, yeah, we open up the learning management system and then I just go on a click frenzy. So and literally just clicking on everything, watching videos, setting everything up. And then, so there is this worry. And there's also a worry that what does get measured is quite reductive as well. So we, as soon as we enter this area, proxy variables, and we have something quite grey and fuzzy like learning, it becomes quite dangerous. So even in terms of engagement, just because I'm watching a video, am I engaged? And so the further on down this track you go, learning analytics, think, well, what else can we generate? What other data can we generate? I know eye tracking through the webcam, so we start tracking people's eyes. And all of a sudden, you're entering this dystopian situation where a student is literally having to look at a screen, move their eyes around, move their mouth around, in order to be deemed to be learning. And then you have to ask yourself, what are we doing here? Is this actually what we want education to be? Is this what we actually think learning is?
You sound like a fan of Black Mirror, Neil.
Well, yes and no, because these systems are in place. I mean, I'm just starting a project on facial recognition in education. And we're looking at how universities are having to flip over to online proctoring. So students are now having to take their exams online. So fair enough, you get surveilled through the students having to set up their iPhones behind them to act as another camera so it can give a sweep of the room to show that no one's helping them cheat. Now that does sound like something from Black Mirror, but it's also something that's going on as we speak now. So yeah, I mean, some of it can be a bit alarmist, but there is this issue about if we reduce things down to data, what gets measured, what doesn't get measured, and also how does that change the way we behave? We have this idea of performativity, whether you're just going on a click frenzy, whether you're teaching to the algorithm, because we all want to make sure we look good on paper or on the screen. And then there's a whole bunch of other issues about ethics and privacy and the data economy and everything else. And I think you put it all together and all of a sudden analytics and data doesn't look so much of a kind of wow technology anymore. It becomes something that we really need to think carefully about if we're going to implement it in a whole school level.
Yeah, and I suppose that question of what is this data representing? What is this sort of drinking from the fire hose problem? You know, what do we want to pick out? What patterns do matter? What patterns don't matter? And that there would be an argument that the way we figure that out is by using machine learning models. You know, using tools like BigQuery from Google, which will actually ingest all the data, find models that work and train against existing data sets. Like you can put in there, you know, this student did really well at the end of the test, so let's look at his attendance all the way back and kind of train towards that and see how close we can match, you know, all the machine learning models to meet that. And then we can apply that to the entire cohort of people in the school and say, we know at year seven, if your attendance was at this level, you're going to be in this problem, and help schools kind of work backwards, if you like, using AI, predicting where they're going to end up. I guess my concern on that is how accurate can those models be? But then are we going to end up with students learning to the AI's needs? So like you said, opening up and going on a click frenzy, because we know that that's a thing that influences me, and I won't get flagged by the student managers and have to explain my, you know, lack of clicking around the learning management system. So that's an interesting idea. But you know, I also think we have to embrace progress at some level, don't we? Like, we can't say, well, okay, that looks really difficult and hard, so we shouldn't, you know, progress too quickly, or we shouldn't try and move fast and innovate here. Like, how should we think about that? I mean, like, yes, we know it's complicated. We know there's privacy issues and all these things. Does that mean we should stop, or does that mean we have to look to government and more policy and governance around the issues? Like, how do we progress here?
I mean, we should always be hopeful and be willing to be surprised and to be open to kind of innovation. And, you know, I've got no problem at all with bringing as much tech into the classroom as possible, as long as it kind of helps everybody and doesn't detract from other stuff. And the danger with a lot of this tech is it can work with particular students in particular circumstances. And as we've been talking about over the last rest of the conversation, if it works for some people, it doesn't mean to say it works for everybody. And so when we're talking about making wholesale changes to a school or even just to a student, I mean, that's their whole life chances. So it's great to kind of experiment with some of these algorithmically driven systems. But if it stuffs up and you have to, you know, close a school down, that really messes up a whole year's worth of students' life chance. And that worries me. So I'm much more interested. I'm not saying the technology doesn't work in practice. I'm not saying it doesn't work in particular circumstances. My worry is when it gets scaled up. So by all means, if it works for you, and this goes for any technology, then go for it in the classroom. But don't then expect your colleagues to have to do it as well, and then everybody else. The machine learning's interesting. We're finding at the moment a lot of AI systems are falling down after COVID-19 because they don't have the data sets to be trained on that model the behaviors that we've all been doing for the past 2 months. So all these machine learning data sets about shopping habits, for example, are just falling off a cliff because
they're empty.
They don't know how we behave in these circumstances. And I bet you if you had a school system that was based around machine learning in the way that supermarkets are, they would also be falling off a cliff. And it's all very well for the supermarket to run out of pasta or toilet roll for a bit. But if we're talking about teaching and learning, I think it's a bit more critical than that. Mm-hmm. So to push things like schools or hospitals or prisons or anything that's really important to society over to technology, we want to be really, really sure that it works. And so it's interesting that you mentioned government and policy. Clearly, I think this needs to be much more policy and government involvement in all of this and oversight in all of this. And the other thing is, why don't we develop some of these technologies ourselves? We're getting solutions parachuted in from Google and Microsoft and big tech companies. Surely education has more of a role to play in the design of these technologies and even the kind of how we imagine these technologies. We don't have to have the technologies that we're given. We can make them for ourselves. So I've loved it to be a kind of a much more communist approach where things are developed by the state and developed by the schools themselves, and then we can bring the tech companies in at the last minute if we need help. I mean, clearly that's very utopian, but the idea of doing technology ourselves or thinking otherwise, and this is why a lot of progressive educators are kind of very much pushed towards open education resources and free, you know, open source software and other forms of using technologies that are not proprietary, that can be you can have a bit more control over, you can tweak yourselves. But there's a whole bunch of problems with that as well, because it means you have to have technological skills and it becomes quite exclusionary within the education system. But it's interesting to think otherwise. If we don't like Google Classroom or, you know, this learning analytics project, could we do it differently ourselves? And how would that be the case? On a more kind of, maybe a more kind of cooperative level. I mean, there's a whole cooperative platforms approach where instead of, you know, having things like Uber or Airbnb, people are kind of organizing themselves and coming up with alternate platforms that maybe don't exploit workers or, you know, suck the data up and sell it to advertisers. So there are ways of doing things. But I think education and educators need to feel a bit more kind of empowered to take control of technology and do it for themselves.
I think, are you familiar with the Ultranet project? I think that's probably been a big thorn in the side of the government taking the reins back. And you see that certainly the state government, you know, big state government systems like New South Wales and Victoria are always erring on the side of, you know, letting a corporation or letting a company deal with student management, deal with classroom assignment setting and those kind of tools, because I think they're scared of that problem again. But also, if something is developed by the government, by the Department of Education for the entire state, what sort of choice does that give schools and what's the incentive to innovate? And that's one of the beauties of the capitalist approach, is that we have choices. We can use Style, we can use Edmodo, we can use Schoology, we can use Google Classroom, we can use Office 365. So we have a way to kind of vote with our feet. One of the sort of critiques I have of a lot of the state systems that are rolled out is we have no say and power to affect change in those systems as one or two individual schools. And even when we do get together, we still don't seem to have much power because no one seems to be able to, you know, like I said, vote with their feet and move to a different product because that's the product we have to use or are mandated to use. So I suppose that's the tension there for me between those two ideals.
Yeah, well, when I first heard of Ultranet, it was the first time I'd heard of this Australian word rort, which I hadn't heard before. It's not an English word at all. Clearly when I talk about the state and the government, I'm talking about an ideal form of government, you know, government and state that kind of is perhaps not as very, very different to the ones that perhaps we have at the moment. So, but I think the public sector, I would always trust the public sector over the private sector. I'm not dismissive of the private sector. And clearly, we can't have the technologies that we have without the private sector. We need Silicon Valley to be innovating, inventing these things. You know, a government-developed laptop would probably be a disaster. But one of the things that I'm interested in is perhaps, I like this idea of people doing it for themselves. It doesn't necessarily have to be the Victorian government trying to build the ultranet. I quite like the idea of collectives of teachers getting together and beginning to develop stuff from the grassroots, bottom up for free. And the whole idea, I mean, the open source and the kind of floss communities of software development has never really kind of challenged things like Facebook or Google, but it's nice to remain hopeful that that could perhaps happen. And those things you can tweak. It's not just having a choice between Microsoft and Facebook and Google. You can actually kind of tweak the fundamentals of these systems. Microsoft, Facebook, and Google are always going to sell your data for third parties. And you know, you don't pay for the product, you are the product. And there's a whole data economy there that's going to get fed. Perhaps, I'm not an advocate for open source or free software at all, but I can see that as an alternative way of maybe circumventing some of the bigger issues and having some of a say in how the technology is used. Having said that, in this pivot over to Zoom, I was very keen to find non-proprietary alternatives to Zoom, and I found a great list of all the things I could use. They were all rubbish. They didn't work at all. Zoom worked really well, and I'm now on Zoom talking to you. So I guess that's the thing about being an academic, is you can come up with these more sort of provocative blue skies things. It wouldn't work at all if I was working in a school on a 9-to-5 basis. But just by saying it, hopefully helps us maybe take time at some point in the year to have a thought about it, and maybe it might push us off in different directions, or it might not. So take everything I say with a pinch of salt, and you know, put everything together and make your own minds up. But there are alternatives. We don't have to just kind of choose from, you know, Google, Apple, Microsoft, or Amazon. That way madness lies.
I'd like to see, you know, time allotted in schools where, even if it's not building new products, you know, not all teachers have those skill sets, but certainly to give feedback to companies and to actually organize their feedback. And so that companies, I think a lot of companies are starved of, well, you know, teachers don't have time to write a feature request in for Google Classroom that they know is going to end up in a black hole. But it would be great if, you know, something like the consortium, the Technology Consortium of Victoria, that's sort of one of the reasons we exist, is we can as a body say, we're all frustrated with this problem, or we all have these similar issues we want to solve. Let's reach out to the people who can solve those and who are incentivized to continually improve on these problems and move them. So, yeah, that's really interesting, fascinating idea.
All these firms have teachers that work. I mean, they're not stupid. They have lots of kind of teachers and social scientists. They have all sorts of people working for companies. So, but it would be nice to think that teachers can be, as you say, involved in the inception and the design and the planning and the testing of these things. You know, I used to work in London in a technology lab, and they would occasionally bring teachers and schools in to kind of test the products out in the wild. And they were always independent schools, you know, the brightest kids that were there in their blazers and their boat. And it's like, that's not testing it in the wild. The trouble is with the technology companies, I guess, is they don't have the time or the energy to do that. And education is not a very profitable market either. So I shouldn't be saying this, given that some of you are involved in tech companies. But, you know, if you're going to be making millions of money, it's probably not from the education market. So perhaps there's not the capitalist incentive for the capitalists to even do a good job in education. Anyway, sorry, I'm kind of spiraling off now into a bit more of a rant. But I think there are some interesting questions here, and nothing is free. I guess that's the one thing I'd say. So even when we're talking about the apps that are being used, teachers are very, very keen to know what they should use and what they should buy. And, you know, all of these things have an impact. When you're choosing a piece of software, it shapes the way you can do things. It shapes the pedagogy. It shapes the whole experience. Just think very carefully about why a piece of software is free and what's in it for the company in some ways.
Look, a rant is perfect for this podcast, Neil. We love a good rant on our podcast. So no, I totally agree. And look, I know I don't want to take up too much of your time, but I did just want to touch on your book very briefly around, you know, should robots replace teachers, or AI in a sense replace teachers, and what that might look like. It'd be great if you could just give us a bit of a quick sort of rundown of the types of threats, I suppose, that schools need to filter and deal with when we're talking about this future of AI and robots in the classroom, from, you know, the back end systems you talk about in your book to the behind the scenes kind of administration systems that we're talking about through teacher analytics, but also, you know, the tutoring pedagogical assistant type of AI and the physical, you know, maybe there's a robot in the classroom or an iPad on wheels floating around telling kids what to do and telling them off for their shirt being untucked. So would you mind just sort of giving us a bit of a rundown on those issues that we need to think about?
Yeah, I mean, I guess first of all, it's interesting to think about what technologies are actually existing in schools now, which are AI. I mean, we're kind of preferring the term automated decision making, just to kind of look. There's all this speculation about what AI could be, but there's a lot of kind of artificial intelligence in schools already, which are making very distinct, discrete, small choices and decisions throughout the school day. And so I'm just really interested in these new technologies. And again, this question of what is new here and what are the outcomes? So, I mean, if you think about it, there are technologies which could go from the beginning of the school day to the end of the school day, which are now making these kind of automated decisions based on data using some form of AI technique. So I think in Victoria, we've had facial recognition class roles where the class role has been taken by a system that says, you know, here are the students in the class, and the teacher doesn't have to take the role. And the claim is it saves a teacher 2.5 hours a week of their time. And then we've got the personalized learning systems that we were talking about before that can kind of recommend to students what they should be learning. And also kind of give some feedback on their performance and how they're feeling. We've got chatbots that can pop up and give kind of respond to student questions. And at the end of the day, we've got automated grading systems that can mark essays and mark assignments. So in theory, a student could go through a school day and not really have to interact with a teacher, which sounds wonderful. And the promise is it's an assistant. It supports teachers. It frees teachers up from the drudge work, allows them to concentrate on pedagogy and teaching students and really getting engaged and, you know, wonderful. My concern is that it doesn't do that at all, that there's a very fine line between being supported and being directed. There's a very fine line between being guided by a system and being told what to do. And so in some ways, there's a worry that teachers are losing fundamentally their kind of autonomy and their expertise and their professionalism. And that you can end up still being a teacher in title, but perhaps not in action. And so it's this idea of not making less work for teachers, but perhaps making worse work for teachers, that we are going to have to just be there stewarding systems, trying to respond to their decisions. And teachers being kind of stripped of their fundamental expertise. So it worries me that we're going to end up in this more robotic system. These aren't physical robots in the classroom. These are all little bits of software doing things around the edges. But I think something is being lost from teaching when we start taking away the autonomy to make decisions. I mean, even just the class role is a really interesting example. Because I've had lots of teachers say to me, oh, I just stuff the role up. I hate the role. Let's not worry about it. Give it to a computer. But if you think about even just taking a class role, you could argue it's a key point in the day where you actually check in with students. You actually so engage with them as a human to say, how you doing? You all right? What's going on? It's a key kind of performance part of the data to get everyone set in the right frame of mind and set everybody off. And so in some ways it seems like a very minor thing to take away from teachers. Same with grading essays. But in some ways you could argue that grading essays is a real pedagogical, you know, a real kind of pedagogical act that, you know, is a really important part of teaching. So it worries me that it's kind of death by a thousand cuts, that in 10 years time teachers are going to be coming to the classroom, seeing what the system tells them to do, and we'll have this kind of very scripted. Some of these systems are even sold as being teacher-proof. It doesn't really matter if you've got a rubbish teacher in the classroom. The systems will make sure that everything happens. And these are very attractive because they're cost-saving. You know, the software never gets sick. Software isn't unionized. And you can see after a while that we don't necessarily need to have people going 4 years through teacher training to become a teacher, that we can get, you know, someone after a year can be a teacher. And then who knows where it's going to go. So it worries me that the automation of the classroom is heading in a way that perhaps isn't necessarily good for teachers and good for students, and the nature of classrooms as places where humans learn together. All of these things might be kind of slowly disappearing. The technology might be great, but we're not even having the conversation about it. We're just letting these things come in because, as you say, we're very busy. We haven't got really time to worry about it. The technology saves a bit of time. But I'm just looking at the longer picture. I wonder where it's all heading. I'm not sure it's heading in a good direction.
Yeah, I would totally agree with that, because I just see that teachers' roles would become data scientists in a sense, and all they're doing is constantly checking the AI to see if they agree or not. And you lose that whole gut teaching in a sense, like teaching from your gut and from observation and things like that. And it's all well and good until you have something like in the Texas, I think it was the Texas, no, where was it? In Texas. Dallas School District, I think, where a whole bunch of teachers got the sack based on a whole bunch of AI reporting that nobody even bothered to have any human interference with and to check on. All of a sudden, it's really affecting teachers in terms of that teacher analytics coming back full circle.
I don't want to get too kind of misty-eyed about this. There are lots of terrible teachers that I'm sure the technology can do a better job than. So I'm not saying humans are better than the technology, but the worry is that the technology is coming in to replace good teachers, medium teachers, and terrible teachers. And in some ways, we don't want to dismiss the technology altogether, which is what Blake was saying. Mm. I'm much more interested in seeing how teachers can work with AI and be more than the sum of the parts and look for examples of AI that aren't just trying to replicate procedural things that we're already doing, but can do new things. I think it was Garry Kasparov, the chess player, who's a big kind of evangelist for AI, talked about when he was playing Big Blue, it began to make moves that no human ever would. It really surprised him. And that fascinates me. Mm. Are there things that AI can do in a classroom that are completely different from the way that we do things now? And if so, brilliant, bring it on. Let's have that in the classroom. And try and use AI to really kind of push things forward and surprise us rather than just replicate the stuff that we're doing already. So,
and also, Neil, to influence the training of teachers, where we look at in the world of computer games, I think there's an AI playing StarCraft at the moment, and all the pro StarCraft players have seen these moves that they've never seen humans do, train on those moves, and now 3-4 times better than they were, than the best player in the world was, you know, 2-3 years ago. So it's rapidly advancing the competitive level of computer games, which is interesting to think about overlaid onto the training of teachers.
Yeah, and we're trying to do a little project at the moment looking at our natural language processing and natural language generation. So there are AI systems now which can produce text from just a few words. How does that change the nature of writing? How does that change the nature of being an author? And how can students learn to work with algorithms and algorithmically generated content in ways that perhaps are different ways of writing or different ways of creating, you know, visual pictures, whatever? That's really interesting. That's really generative. If we're using the systems merely just to kind of make sure that teachers don't have to get paid to grade essays, or teachers, you know, don't have to give advice to students during the day, then I think that's a worry. So perhaps we're focusing the AI at the wrong place. But you can see why companies are focusing AI on essay grading and attendance, because that's what the people that buy these systems, you know, school managers, school leaders, and kind of policymakers, that's what that helps the system. So this is what I was getting at before. If teachers actually said, well, here from a classroom point of view is a really interesting example of how AI might be used, why don't we explore that? But people aren't having those conversations. So I'm not anti the technology, but the technology is being rolled out in ways that aren't perhaps making the most of it, and are perhaps a bit detrimental to what makes a school so special.
Yeah, I certainly talked to, have you heard of Soul Machines out of Auckland?
No.
No, you should have a look at them. They're looking at things like creating AI personalities, and it's based off, you know, modeling off real people. And they claim that it's like neural networks they're trying to build so that it'll be able to understand situations and scale up or scale down and handle different, you know, different emotions and different things like that. And so one of the projects they just played around on the edge is with an AI teacher that would be able to work with students to get them to a point and free the teacher up to do their job. So there's definitely companies that are playing around the edges of that. And I often show that in keynotes when I'm speaking at schools around the future of tech. And it's really interesting, this response you get from some teachers. Some teachers are all for it because they can, like you say, they see themselves being freed up to do what they do best, which is engage with students and build relationship and have that human touch. And others are completely freaked out by it, thinking, well, there goes the teaching career. So it'll be interesting to see over the next 10 years where that falls out, for sure.
Yeah, you might be making a podcast for kind of AI-generated bot teachers in 10 years' time. But
yeah, who knows? That's good. Excellent. Well, no, I'm just conscious of the time, Neil. Really appreciated your insights and your thoughts and your wisdom around some of this stuff. It's been great having a chat. Blake, over to you.
Yeah, thank you again, Neil. And look, where do people go if they want to find out more, Neil?
Having Slack technology off for an hour, the best place to go is Twitter. So @Neil_Selwyn. Pretty much most things I do are on Twitter.
Fantastic. And look, thanks again for taking the time. You're always following what you're doing around the place, Neil. So appreciate you having, you know, this conversation with us. And I'm hopeful that it questions some of the norms and makes people sort of reflect a little bit on their technology journeys in their schools. And look, just thanks a million for coming on again.
No worries. Thanks a lot. Good luck.
Excellent. Thanks, Neil. See ya. Excellent. So that was a really good interview. And I just feel like that could have gone on for a lot longer. Hey, in terms of a lot of questions I had there, but we might have to get Neil back onto the podcast in the future.
And, absolutely. We should get everyone to tweet at him and tell everyone, you know, tell him how much they enjoyed him coming on, and hopefully get him back to really dig in down deep. We sort of had a bit of a surface look at his research and his work today, but it'd be great to dive in deep on some of these topics.
Yeah, absolutely. And we'll link up some of those articles that he's referenced in the show notes as well. And so go to the show notes at usingtechnologybetter.com. And if you're looking for all the different podcasts that have got all the different show notes and summaries in, just go to utb.fyi/outclassed, which is there. Speaking of Twitter, it'd be really good, Blake, if we had some people tweeting out what they're learning or sharing some of their ideas, agree with us, disagree with us, but use the hashtag outclasspodcast. And we'd love to hear from you, and we'll be able to respond there as well. Just thinking about wins and fails this week, Blake, what's on your radar?
Well, one big win at the moment is Windows. Windows have got a new package manager called WinGet. And if anyone has ever used Linux, use this thing called apt-get. And it can basically download any package straight away, knows all the dependencies, puts it on your computer. Windows never had that. And it's pretty exciting from a sysadmin point of view. It's going to save a lot of time. And it's just good that they're sort of living in the 21st century now. So that's a big win for Windows and Microsoft. Well done. In terms of my fail this week, it's just around questions I'm getting online and from other schools around coming back. And, you know, post-COVID, we're seeing a lot around innovation. Schools saying we're innovating, we want to innovate, let's do remote, let's do learning management better, let's, you know, free up kids. And I think there's a misunderstanding between what's innovation and what's just using a new tool. So really look at what are the goals of your school, what are the things you're trying to do in your AIP or strategic plan, and try and innovate in those areas. Innovation is not, you know, using a new app to record the attendance on a Google Meet necessarily. So, you know, is that in line with what your goals are? Try and just keep focused on that. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's one of those areas we could have dug in deeper with Neil on, to be honest. Like, everything's got steps to it, right, in a journey. So you're taking a step in the right direction. You're calling it innovation. Maybe what's innovation to one man is not to another, but I definitely take your point. We're working with some schools right now just to take a step back and evaluate and have a look at what worked and where you can do it, and not settle. I think this is what you're trying to say. Like, don't settle for a small change when right now you could take a big leap forward. And so look beyond that. Okay, let's take this learning and apply it to, what would happen if we took the next three things and applied that at the same time.
Absolutely. Look for that visionary idea and see how close you can get. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think there are certain moments in time where things can be accelerated. And I feel like this is one of those times where sometimes it might take you a year to implement a project. Maybe now you could implement a project and have everyone on board in 3 months, because maybe we're just in that place where people have settled into the sense of change. And before things settle back to how they were, just use that disruptive moment just to push your agenda just a little bit harder. So I'd see that as a win and a fail. Speaking of wins, I was just looking at our statistics for the podcast, Blake, and we've got a few reviews starting to come through on iTunes, which is great. We've got a 5-star rating. That would appreciate anyone who's using Apple devices. I don't, unfortunately, I choose not to, but it would be great if you're using Apple to give us a rating and maybe leave a comment so other people can see a little bit about what you appreciate about the podcast. But it's definitely out on all the different players. And I think we're up to just over 600 downloads, I think, in the last 2 or 3 weeks. So pretty happy with that as a start. And we'd love you to share the podcast with those that are listening with you or around you in your faculties, in your school or in your community.
Yeah, big thanks to everyone for listening. That's amazing. A great start, and looking forward to many more. And of course, you know, this is recorded a couple of weeks ahead, but one of the things we're focusing on is getting this closer to when you're actually listening. So, you know, we can be as at the minute as possible.
Yeah, I was even just reflecting with my wife this morning. It's pretty amazing. Like, I've seen a few people start podcasts during COVID because they had all this time on their hands, and I thought, oh, perfect time to start a podcast. But for us, it's been the busiest season we've had in years, I think. And for us to get the podcast out, but it's been a real enjoyment and a real great part of my week just to be able to sit down on a call with you and interview some really innovative people and people who are, causing us to think a little bit differently. And that's always good when we jump on a call just to challenge each other in our thinking as well. So it's been a good opportunity around the podcast, and we're certainly looking forward to doing a lot more of them. And we'd love to hear from anyone listening to the podcast. If you want to leave us a voice message, we'd like to include that podcast coming up soon. You can do that on the usingtechnologybetter.com website. There's a big button that just says leave a message. They can do that, or shoot us an email, hit us up on Twitter. We're all over the place where you can find us. So again, Blake, appreciate you taking time out of your week, and we'll catch you next week.
Thank you, Mike.
Thanks for listening. For more episodes and show notes, visit utb.fyi/outclassed.